Nakayama replied. Nope. Doesn't ring a bell.
Well, the situation at the present is that Trip Hawkins of Electronic Arts has found a way to reverse engineer the Genesis, and now they have decided to make games without our approval.
Kalinske was floored. Didn't we just release some of their games?
Yes, Nakayama said. You must go to Electronic Arts and show them that we mean the business.
Kalinske sighed deeply, looking at the fax machine. At least he had Sonic. At least there was that. Chapter 9. Tripped Up. Don't act so surprised, snapped Trip Hawkins, the brilliant but mercurial founder of Electronic Arts. You had to imagine it would only be a matter of time. On Nakayama's instructions, Kalinske had traveled with Ryo, Toyota, and Sega's legal counsel, Riley Russell, to the offices of Electronic Arts, where they met with Hawkins, marketing wizard Bing Gordon, CEO Larry Probst, and EA's legal counsel. Over the past several months, negotiations had been going on between the companies about how to proceed now that EA had reverse-engineered the Genesis. It was a potentially fatal situation that could knock Sega out before they ever really entered the ring. Kalinske wondered what other problems were out there, ones that he didn't yet know about. After all, he had only just recently been informed of the fiasco involving Sega's planned football game. As part of Michael Katz's plan to hitch Sega's wagon to a constellation of superstars, the company had signed Joe Montana to a $1.7 million licensing agreement. Since Sonic wouldn't be released until next year, late 1991, Joe Montana Football was intended to be the flagship title for the Genesis, the game that branded Sega, the game that sold consoles, the game that kids begged Santa for this Christmas. The problem, though, was that Sega's games were designed in Japan, where they didn't know the first thing about football. So Katz had decided to find a software developer in the West who could create a quality product in a short period of time. Luckily, a local software company called Mediagenic already had a football game in development that was about 30% complete. It was far enough along that it could be ready in time for Christmas, but unfinished enough that there was still room for it to be built around Montana. A few weeks before Kalinske joined Sega, however, Katz had discovered that the game was nowhere near complete. Ironically, when Katz found out about this, his first call was to Hawkins in the hopes that EA would sell them their new John Madden football game and allow Sega to tweak it and rename it after Joe Montana. But Hawkins refused, believing he had a hot franchise in the making. Come now. You must have something to say? Hawkins asked. Comments? Questions? Perhaps a more eloquent form of flabbergast? I guess the only question that comes to mind is how the hell you pulled it off, but I suspect that I don't truly want to know the answer to that. Hawkins didn't respond, but his eyes shone with the glimmer of a shooting star swiftly slashing through the sky, one about to crash down to Earth and destroy everything in its path. It had all started about a year ago when Hawkins had a significant change of heart. Since founding Electronic Arts, he had been viciously resistant to the idea of creating software for video game consoles. He saw them as pesky toys, nothing at all compared to the future of personal computers. This mindset had made him look like a genius when Atari blew up in 1983, but by 1987, when the Nintendo phenomenon was in full effect, it made him look like some combination of foolish and pretentious. Even as Nintendo continued to rise, Hawkins vehemently defended his position, believing that the NES was no more than a Cabbage Patch Kid-like fad, and reminding his employees that the computer was the future. Besides, the graphics on the NES were mediocre at best and couldn't handle EA's enormous talents. But this all changed with Skate or Die. With pressure mounting from his EA cohorts, Hawkins finally agreed to a small concession. He would allow EA to license their game Skate or Die to another software company named Konami, granting them rights to distribute the game on various other systems, including the NES. The decision to forego directly putting the game on the Nintendo, yet allowing it to happen anyway, may seem strange, but it stemmed mostly from the fact that Hawkins simply didn't want to deal directly with Nintendo and their strict licensing agreements, which didn't exist in the computer world. EA received only a fraction of what Konami had made, which was only a fraction of what Nintendo had made. But the royalty from Skate or Die for the first month alone was more money than EA made on its best-selling computer games. It was then that Hawkins decided, while personal computers were still the future, console games apparently were also the future. Yet despite this realization, Hawkins still couldn't stomach the notion of becoming beholden to Nintendo, which caused him to take a closer look at Sega. From a technical standpoint, the Genesis, with its 16 bits and 68,000 Motorola processor, was better equipped to handle EA's games. But even though Sega had such a puny market share, their licensing agreement wasn't all that different from Nintendo's. The rates were cheaper, of course, but conceptually they both believed that the hardware companies deserved to be paid a toll by the software makers. So to avoid this, Hawkins arranged for Electronic Arts to reverse engineer the Genesis. Unlike Tengen, who bent the law to discover a workaround, EA would do this legally by setting up a clean room environment, which would create a Chinese wall between the engineers dismantling the machine and the engineers trying to rebuild it with the desired change, in this case circumventing the console's lockout system. Now, a year later, Trip Hawkins excitedly stood before the guys from Sega with the grandeur of someone who had just knocked over a little boy's sandcastle. "All right, Trip," Kalinske said, while replaying the connect-the-dots of the crap that had made up his day. "Tell me how you did it." "Eh, who cares?" Hawkins mused. "A to B to C to D, and here we are. The question is, now what? What do you think is fair?"
"You're getting nothing," Ryo bellowed. "I'll bet you they didn't legally reverse-engineer the thing. Those guys are too dirty to ever bother with a clean room."
"Would you really like to gamble away your company on a hunch?" Hawkins asked. He turned to Kalinske. "You're new to these conversations. What say you?" Kalinske snickered. "Who cares what I think? You're holding all the cards." Hawkins struck a defensive tone. "You can drop the high and mighty routine. You think I wanted to do this? You think I like driving off the course? How is this my fault? You, Katz Nakayama, and those zombies at Nintendo, you guys just don't get it. I spend years making a game, hundreds of thousands of dollars in development costs, and then when it comes time to recoup, I need to buy the cartridges from you, get your saintly blessing, and then after all that, pay you $10 for every game I sell." When Hawkins finished, Kalinske remained silent for a moment, this time by choice. Finally, he said, "What? No fake tears? I mean, if you're going to lob a sob story at me, at least you can go the whole nine yards." The Sega team couldn't help but crack smiles.
"I'm not being dramatic. I'm not by nature a dramatic person," Hawkins said, which might have been the falsest statement he had ever spoken.
"It's the price of doing business," Kalinske said. "Those thousands you spent on making games? What about the millions we spent making consoles? We barely break even on those systems. We're giving away razors in order to sell the blades."
"But they're my blades." "Yeah, well, they're our razors," Kalinske shouted.
Toyota nudged Kalinske in an attempt to calm him down.
Hawkins shot up. "Steve Jobs is an obsessive maniac, and even he doesn't make us pay him money to put our games on his computers."
This was, after all, the basis for Hawkins' stubbornness. He came from the computer world, where anybody can make any game for any system. In some cases, the computer manufacturer even paid you money to develop for their system. Kalinske sighed.
"Oh, Trip, didn't your mother ever teach you the difference between right and wrong?" Hawkins sighed, too. "Oh, Tom, the funny things a man will say when he's down in the fourth quarter."
Though the banter briefly lifted Kalinske's mood, that comment reminded him of the Joe Montana football problems. Even if Sega and EA found a way to play nice, there was still that to deal with. These battles with EA, Japan, and Walmart only served to take Sega's eyes off Nintendo and weren't worth fighting. Kalinske briefly discussed the situation with Ryo, Toyota, and Russell. They all agreed that having a close relationship with Electronic Arts, even if it wasn't profitable, would be an incredible win for Sega. EA made great games, which was exactly what Sega needed at the moment. To make that happen and also save face, Toyota came up with the strategy that he whispered to the others.
"Okay," Ryo said. "How about we play Let's Make a Deal?"
"I don't like game shows,"
Hawkins replied. The hosts freak me out. Well, despite your strange phobia, Kalinske said, here's what we propose. Sega will grant you permission to make authorized games for the Genesis, and instead of the $10 for the cartridges, we'll only charge you $4.
And?
Kalinske looked into his eyes. This really was a shakedown. In addition to the 60% cost reduction, Sega would also allow EA to publish up to 16 games per year and self-manufacture their cartridges. Hawkins took this in. That all sounds well and swell, but you're forgetting that we can do all of this for free. No, I'm forgetting nothing. I'm sure you realize that if you go through with this, you're going to bankrupt both our companies with lawsuits back and forth. Hawkins thought this over, warming to the idea. So that's your final offer? Actually, there's something else that we want from you, Kalinske said. In exchange for keeping us out of court and saving us both from ever having to have a conversation about razors and razor blades again, I want you to give us Madden.
No way!
Hawkins yelped. What about for some cash and promotion?
It's not about the money,
Hawkins said. Kalinske understood and respected that. He knew from Mattel that these weren't stocks, bonds, and commodities that they were selling. These are emotions, experiences, and ideas. Why don't you use EA's Madden engine to make our Montana game? Same gameplay, but switch everything up so that it looks and feels different. If you guys can help us out with this, we'd even be willing to offer EA a nice royalty on Montana sales. Hawkins stroked his chin, playing out scenarios in his always whirling mind. Essentially, EA would take their own game and tweak it enough so that the customers didn't realize that John Madden football and Joe Montana football were actually the same game. Hawkins thought that this was a crazy idea, insane even. But it was a crazy idea that would leave Kalinske and company holding the bag if people ever figured it out. And in the meantime, EA had managed to get the Sega royalty offer up to 24% of this proposed Madden-turned-Montana game. Hawkins extended his hand across the desk, and Kalinske did the same. It was a perfect moment. Until Hawkins felt compelled to speak again.
I just want to say that there really is a way of looking at this where I'm the good guy and you're the bad guy.
He nodded rapidly, seemingly trying to persuade not only Kalinske but himself.
There's a way of looking at this where I'm the hero who chops through the bullshit and oppression in order to come out the other end with a spoonful of freedom. Please don't say another word, Kalinske said, trying to put an end to the long, arduous day.
Every time you open your mouth, it makes me feel like I've just made a huge mistake.
Chapter 10. Extremely dangerous. Don't try this at home. Another day, another plane. Kalinske's go-go-go life was starting to feel eerily familiar to that of his Matchbox days, where he spent most of his time waiting in airport lines, flying through the sky, and landlocked in places where his watch didn't match up with the local time. At least now he had company.
Are you ready to have some fun? Nilsson asked as he and Kalinske walked up the steps to the New Orleans Convention Center.
Honestly, I'm ready for anything that does not involve reverse engineering or defanging hedgehogs, Kalinske said, as they were about to enter the 1991 Amusement and Music Operators Association, AMOA, Expo. The AMOA trade show was exciting, confusing, and carnivalesque as its name made it sound. The organization had been created in 1948 when 68 angry jukebox owners banded together to fight against paying royalties on the songs their machines played. Out of that alliance came the idea to hold an annual trade show that would bring together various parts of their niche universe, from jukebox designers and equipment distributors to bar owners and music producers, basically anyone who had a stake in customers inserting quarters into a jukebox. Meanwhile, as the prestige of the AMOA grew, it began to attract the attention of companies producing other mechanized products that offered entertainment in exchange for coins, such as air hockey tables, love testers, and eventually, arcade games. As jukeboxes and the less interactive diversions of yesteryear waned in popularity, the arcade business became the dominant species of coin-operated entertainment. Kalinske knew little about arcade games beyond what he'd learned watching his daughters play Frogger or Miss Pac-Man at pizza places.
Eager to replace his ignorance with competence, he was excited to enter the show. As soon as they stepped inside, Kalinske felt as if he'd been directly transported into the imagination of a 5-year-old. Row after row of pinball machines, kiddie rides, and arcade cabinets as far as the eye could see. Ironically, out of the thousands in attendance, there wasn't a single child in sight. "So how does this work?" Kalinske asked.
"It's great. There are a couple hundred booths here, about half of which are utterly absurd," Nilsson said, pointing to a man in a suit eagerly grasping for swirling dollars inside a tall, translucent rectangle. "While we occasionally take a moment out of our busy schedules to mock that half, we'll mostly be trying out arcade games, scoping out trends, and seeing if there's anything we should consider licensing as a Genesis game. Then we ought to sync up with the Sega of Japan arcade folks so they can meet you and see that now we're for real. Sound good?"
"Very.
I mean, you basically just said that we get paid to play games.
That's why we have the best job on Earth."
It was a great job. Or at least parts of it were great.
As a lifelong sports fan, Kalinske had a tendency to think of things in terms of athletic analogies. Normally, he played the role of coach, motivating and instructing Team Sega, or general manager, wheeling and dealing, like with Walmart and EA. But today, he got to play the role of scout, purely an observer, looking for diamonds in the rough. When teams won, coaches and general managers were the gods responsible for every speck of greatness. But when they lost, they were incompetent morons who didn't deserve the oxygen they were breathing. Given all that, today's anonymity was a nice respite from those two opposite, yet equally irrational perspectives.
"So," Nilsson said, "shall we get down to business?"
Though they spent a pleasant afternoon checking out what was new in the arcade realm, the real excitement was reserved for the pay-per-view boxing match that evening. Prior to Kalinske's arrival, Nilsson and then-President Michael Katz had taken a risk investing in a franchise built around Buster Douglas, a no-name boxer who had recently defied 42-1 odds and knocked out the heavyweight champion of the world, Mike Tyson. Part of their gamble was based on an appreciation for the young boxer's scrappy fighting style, but the larger part was based on a desire to stick it to Nintendo, who published the popular game Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. To rub it in Nintendo's face, Sega wanted to fast-track their new boxing game so that it would be ready for release shortly after Douglas's next match. But given how long it normally takes to design, create, test, and finalize a game, about a year, it would not be possible to start from scratch in February, when Douglas defeated Mike Tyson, and be ready in time for October, when Douglas would, everyone hoped, knock out Evander Holyfield. So Nilsson asked Hugh Bowen, a product manager he had hired and trusted, to find a good, already complete boxing game that Sega could buy and essentially slap Douglas's face onto. He had some concerns about this type of approach, but after all, that's what Nintendo had done with their famed boxing game. It originally had been called Punch-Out until Nintendo's Minoru Arakawa signed Mike Tyson, threw him on the cover, and made him the final fighter players had to beat in order to win the game. That had obviously worked out nicely for Nintendo, and Nilsson wanted to replicate the recipe for Sega, though, as always, he'd wanted to spice it up a little. Instead of fighting against the professional boxers if he were some kind of villain, he wanted players to enjoy the experience of being a pro boxer. Hope became reality when Bowen found an arcade game called Final Blow made by Taito. Needing to act fast, Nilsson quickly inspected and approved the game to be busterized. Kat signed off on the plan, and Nakayama arranged a deal to use the boxing title on the Genesis. Sega's R&D took Taito's game and made the minor but necessary alterations, such as swapping the Detroit Kid, the game's original main character, with Buster Douglas, and then racing against time to have the game ready for release within a month of Douglas's first fight as champion, which was, finally, tonight. "By the way," Nilsson said as they played a blood-spattering zombie game, "at some point we should see what the folks at Gottlieb are up to."
"Gottlieb," Kalinske nodded.
"They're the ones who made Qbert, right?"
"Hey, look at that! You're really getting a firm grasp on the business."
"Slowly but surely," Kalinske said, almost surprised to realize he was indeed starting to get a handle on things. "Slowly but surely." Nilsson smiled.
"Don't worry, I won't tell anyone.
We'll try to keep expectations as low as possible, so it's that much more impressive when you shock the world.
That night, Kalinske and Nilsson got to the sports bar early to stake out a prime position for the fight. Neither being a particularly big drinker, they each nursed a beer, shared some appetizers, and reflected on Kalinske's crash course in the arcade industry.
So, any grand observations? Nilsson asked.
Nothing too crazy, Kalinske said, scanning through his memories of the day. It had been as light and enjoyable as he hoped for. They'd spent some time with the Sega of Japan arcade guys, who had some cool things in the pipeline, but seemed a bit standoffish. And then they had indeed gone to the Taito booth, where they'd seen a game that Nilsson liked called Hit the Ice. It was a hockey game, but unlike typical hockey games, this one featured only three players per team, forward, defense, and goalie. Even more unusual was that the players were encouraged to break the rules by slashing, tripping, and kicking opponents in the groin. It was cartoony and ridiculous, but definitely fun.
Still, all things being equal, Kalinske started, trying to find the words to match his mild discomfort. I could do without all the violence. Lots of those games we saw seemed to be a bit excessive with the blood and gore.
Doesn't any of that stuff ever bother you?
I don't love it, but it doesn't get to me, Nilsson shrugged. Besides, the arcade games tend to be a bit racier. They're usually made for an audience a little older than what we're doing with the Genesis.
Kalinske subtly shivered. I just hate the idea of using that garbage to sell games, you know?
I absolutely do, Nilsson said, right there on the same wavelength. But the good news is that we don't need that stuff to make great games. And at the end of the day, that's really all that matters. Just remember, the name of the game is the game.
I've heard you say that before.
And you'll hear me say it again, because it's true.
The name of the game is the game?
The game has to be good. That's all that matters. That's the only thing.
Kalinske nodded.
Getting it.
And glad to have an excuse to feed his conscience. He looked across the table and tried to find a way to express his appreciation. This had really been a nice day. A great respite from the time he spent in front of a firing squad. But as he sought a way to savor the moment, he was interrupted by an excited hubbub inside the sports bar as the fight was about to start.
Kalinske and Nilsson looked up at the TV, and despite their best efforts to play it cool, they couldn't help but do a double take. Their fighter, the heavyweight champion of the world, the face of their new game franchise, did not look like the face Sega had signed. Douglas was bloated, at least 15 pounds overweight, and even as he danced around in his boxing trunks, he looked sluggish. The guys looked at each other.
Uh-oh, Nilsson said. The words quickly proved to be prophetic. Holyfield overmatched his chubby opponent and knocked out Douglas in the third round. After it ended, and Douglas was put out of his misery, Kalinske looked at his shell-shocked Nilsson.
Don't worry, he said. Everything is going to be okay.
Somehow I doubt that, Nilsson said, unable to think about anything besides how hard he'd worked to get the game ready in such a short amount of time, and how the press was going to have a field day with this.
Kalinske put a hand on his friend's shoulder.
We'll be fine. Instead of spending a celebratory night in New Orleans, victory dancing their way through the Big Easy, stopping only to tell anyone who appeared willing to listen that Sega was for real and Nintendo had better watch themselves, they went back to their rooms and called it an early night. Back in his hotel room, Kalinske wondered how so much had gone so wrong in such a short amount of time. He was beginning to worry that the vaunted reputation he'd built over 2 decades might quickly and irrevocably sink with Sega. He had come to the company with the goal of giving it an identity, but the more he learned, the more uncertain he became of what that identity might be. In a few weeks, he was supposed to get in front of Sega's board of directors and tell them his plan for how Sega could become competitive. What was he supposed to say? Maybe he ought to just stand in front of them, shake his head, and succinctly say, "Let's just give up." To subdue these thoughts, Kalinske turned on the TV. There were only 12 channels, though one of them, the hotel boasted, was HBO.
but that would be enough to provide him with the numbing therapy of television. You watch the middle of some Sean Connery movie, trying to figure out if this was a James Bond movie or not. When the film went to a commercial, he quickly forgot all about the movie. There's something going on with this commercial, and it got his juices flowing. It began with the quaint, to grandmother's house we go bridge. Plain, pretty, picturesque. And then, after the visual lullaby, it hits you. Boom! A warning appears on the screen. Extremely dangerous. Don't try this. Two men stand on the bridge, preparing to jump into a tumultuous body of water. The man in Nike Air shoes breathes nervously, while the other bends down to add some air to his pump shoes made by Reebok. Just then, the audience realizes they are bungee jumping. In slow motion, the two men spread their arms and jump. Downward they go, soaring with immaculate weightlessness as time seems to stand still. Until suddenly their bungee cords snap them back. The man in the Reebok pumps dangles upside down, safely above the water. Meanwhile, the other bungee cord can be seen, but the man is gone, and all that remains are his flimsy Nike Air shoes. After it ended, Kalinske stared at the television screen. This was it. This was the message. Edgy, sarcastic, clever, and fun. The ad perfectly summed up Kalinske's vague and disjointed notions of how Sega should define itself and its products. How had he pulled this off? He didn't know, and right now he didn't care. He wanted to play the commercial again over and over. He wanted to call Karen or Nilsson or even Nakayama and say, I've got it. But truly, he didn't know what he had. Luckily, he had the rest of the night to figure that out. The following morning, Kalinske met Nilsson downstairs for breakfast at the hotel restaurant. Though he didn't have any tangible reason to feel upbeat, he seemed to be as cheerful as the bright yellow walls. How'd you sleep? Kalinske asked as they took their seats. Nilsson, normally a man of many words, answered by placing a copy of USA Today on the table, which featured a cover story on Buster Douglas's embarrassing loss. Kalinske slowly shook his head. How screwed are we? Nilsson opened his briefcase and pulled out the documents related to product development budgets and schedules. Everything's already been manufactured and shipped. The cartridges, game cases, manuals, and everything else are on a boat somewhere in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, so, in short, very screwed. Yeah, I figured, Kalinske said. He knew this to be factually correct, but there was something about that commercial last night that made him feel resilient. But still, come on. There must be something we can do. I mean, the fact that an obscure boxer knocked out the champ and then got fat and lazy doesn't change the fact that we have a better product than Nintendo, right? In a way, it's almost comical. Before Kalinske finished the sentence, Nilsson's mind was already furiously at work. That's how it went with him. Often he'd seem to suddenly zone out, but actually that was when he was most zoned in. He would become bombarded with images, related and unrelated alike. Buster Douglas, game cartridges, the Pacific Ocean, bright yellow walls, refreshing orange juice with its tiny bits of pulp. These seemingly random remnants of memory would collide against an eclectic soundtrack in his head. A chord from Beethoven, a crash from MC Hammer, and the eternal optimism of that zestfully clean commercial, and in a matter of seconds, unlikely connections formed. Nilsson knew that some creative types worked slowly and deliberately, but that was the complete opposite of how his mind worked. Wait, Nilsson proclaimed. Let's make it a cool inside joke. I like it, Kalinske said. But don't quite understand. What do you mean? Let's not run from this thing. We've got egg all over our face, but instead of running to go wipe it off and pretending like it never happened, let's just not wipe off the egg. Let's stand here, embarrassed, and just laugh at ourselves. So we turn into the skid. Exactly! We embrace the failure. Maybe we even turn the game into a collector's edition. But whatever we do, we don't run and hide. After all, even though it's named after an overweight former heavyweight champion, it does happen to be a really fun game. And the name of the game is the game. Nilsson nodded, proud of his boss. So, what do you say?
At the time, Kalinske couldn't have known that by going along with this plan, James Buster Douglas Knockout Boxing would go on to be a critical and commercial success. He didn't know that the game would sell so well that Sega would have to order a second shipment, and that upon its re-release, it would be packaged with the tongue-in-cheek branding of Sega Classics. And he didn't know that this game, and the company's laugh-at-us stance in releasing it, would give Sega a certain credibility and coolness with gamers and the press. At the moment, Kalinske didn't know any of these things. But he knew that what Nilsson said was the best idea he had heard in a long time. And for them to have any chance of pulling off the impossible, it was exactly the type of thing they needed Sega to become. The fun, rebellious, sarcastic underdog. "Let's do it," Kalinske said, with the enormous confidence, fearlessness, and appreciation the idea deserved. Chapter 11. Lightning in a Bottle. It is a rare thing for five smart, skeptical adults to be so awed that in unison, their jaws drop in astonishment. But what Kalinske, Ryo, Toyota, Nilsson, and Schroeder were staring at in the conference room was quite possibly the most extraordinary thing they'd ever seen. An early, incomplete, minute-long demo for Sonic the Hedgehog. The game was so fast, so exhilarating, and so unlike anything they'd ever seen before, that their facial responses hardly did it justice. "This is..." Kalinske began. "This is genius." "A work of art," Schroeder chimed in.
"A home run," Toyota declared.
"Consider my expectations exceeded," Ryo added.
They looked to Nilsson, their resident gamer, for his assessment.
"Eh, it's okay,"
Nilsson said, drawing blank stares from his colleagues.
"Actually, wait, that didn't sound right. Can I borrow someone's sarcasm?
Mine doesn't seem to be up to snuff." The five of them, like bank robbers who had just completed an unbelievable heist, continued to stare at the game and allow themselves to indulge in a series of what-ifs. What if Sega could change the way video games were played and perceived? What if they could take off the gloves, pound their chests, and declare war? What if they could actually go after Nintendo? When Kalinske returned from New Orleans, this was exactly the kind of fearless ambition he wanted his team to harbor as he prepared for his big trip to Japan. The employees now admired him. He was smart, approachable, and inspiring. He was a man obsessed with competitive advantages, and soon enough, that kind of strategic thinking became infectious. Between his vision, Ryo's meticulous day-to-day management of operations, and Toyota's constant efforts to protect America from Japan, the what-ifs began bubbling inside Sega's employees. But to fully believe, they needed something to see. And that's what Sonic the Hedgehog was. Proof of possibility. "This is it," Kalinske said, fixated on Sonic, their beloved blue hedgehog, who somehow managed to come across as both rebellious and adorable. This was the character who would embody the Sega spirit and give them a puncher's chance against Nintendo's 16-bit machine.
"We need everyone to see this," Kalinske proclaimed, and then stuck his head out the door and invited everyone in the office to check it out. The Sega of America employees gathered around the television set and had the same reaction that had just occurred in the five who'd first seen it.
"This is... wow," an astounded employee said.
"Holy crap," said another. "We're going to sell a million of these, aren't we?"
It was, of course, intended to be nothing more than a rhetorical comment, but the idea of having something that a million people would want to buy sent Kalinske's mind into overdrive. The combination of seeing this game, Sega's new busterized attitude, and the fact that more great software was on its way, both internally and from Electronic Arts, led him to what he believed was a game-changing realization.
"No, we're not," Kalinske said.
"We're not going to sell a single one of these.
And that's exactly what I'm going to tell Japan."
Chapter 12. The Revolution Will Be Pixelated. Kalinske, with Toyota by his side,
stood in front of 18 unimpressed Japanese men, Sega's board of directors. The room was stuffy and claustrophobic, and the atmosphere inside it gave it the impression that a bout of laughter might be punishable by death. The only sympathetic face in the crowd belonged to Nakayama, though Kalinske noticed that in this context there was something different about his demeanor. Among the board members, he seemed less like an excitable and affable business visionary, and more like a cheerfully cunning Machiavellian politician. Nevertheless, Nakayama's presence was a relief. He was the man who had believed in Kalinske even before Kalinske believed in himself.
"Let us begin," Nakayama said with a nod to Kalinske, and then a briefer one to Toyota.
"Ready?" Kalinske asked Toyota, who would be translating for him.
"Always and never," his translator answered.
"Excellent," Kalinske said, with a hint of "here goes nothing" in his voice. Kalinske never felt more at ease, more like himself, than when he was speaking to a crowd. As he began, whatever nervousness he had been feeling instantly evaporated, and he possessed the confidence of a man who believed he could convince anyone of anything. "Members of the board, I want to thank you very much for inviting me here today to speak with you," Toyota dutifully translated. "It is both an honor and a privilege to be asked to share my thoughts with you," he continued. When Kalinske had first taken the job, Nakayama advised him that as soon as he had gotten his bearings, he would be invited to speak with the board and provide his assessment of Sega, his opinions on the burgeoning video game industry, and plans for how the company might be able to carve out a bigger piece of the market. Kalinske understood this was something of a formality, but initially he'd been worried that after only a few months he wouldn't have much to say. Now, however, he was worried he wouldn't have enough time to say everything on his mind. Simply put, the video game industry was nothing more than a modern, pixelated version of the Wild West. There were no rules, no code of ethics, and absolutely no law, except for Nintendo's attempt to appoint themselves sheriff. Consequently, Kalinske was in a position to implement his own laws. And today, in front of these unimpressed gentlemen, that was exactly what he planned to do. Kalinske had trekked to Japan to deliver his four-point plan, a bold vision that he hoped would turn video games into an acceptable, cool, mainstream activity. If Nintendo'd fancied themselves as makers of the ultimate toy, well, then let them have their children. Sega was ready to scoop up everybody else. The hardcore gamers who demanded only the best. The teenagers who were always looking for new ways to procrastinate. And even Nintendo's precious children when they were a few years older and ready for something more sophisticated. So instead of standing in front of the board of directors with a saccharine smile, appeasing eyes, a double thumbs up, and an assurance that he'd keep on course, he'd showed up with a proposal that he believed would either flip the gaming landscape upside down or blow it up in spectacular fashion. "I hope that my suggestions, observations, and criticisms do not offend you, but are accepted in the spirit in which they are intended," Kalinske began. "We all want what's best for Sega. And I truly believe that over the next few years, we can go from wanting the best to being the best." He had organized his thoughts about how to reach that next level into four easily understandable areas of attack, beginning with the most controversial. 1. Games. When customers purchased a Sega Genesis, it currently came bundled with the game Altered Beast. That had to stop. Yes, it was a popular arcade game, but like most arcade games, it was too short, too repetitive, and too unsophisticated when played at home with limitless time. Plus, Middle America had complained that the name Altered Beast sounded like devil worship. This was all completely unacceptable. Sega had to put their best foot forward and bundle with its consoles the game that absolutely, positively would differentiate them from Nintendo. Sonic the Hedgehog. Giving away their best game for free would cost the company tens of millions, but it should be considered an investment that would help them make hundreds of millions down the line. 2. Price. As he had mentioned to Trip Hawkins, Kalinske believed in the Gillette philosophy of giving away the razors in order to sell the blades. And with over 30 million American homes owning the NES, Sega had to be willing to take a loss on sales of the Genesis hardware just to get it through the door. Once they had established an installed base, then they'd start making back their money by selling games. Not only that, but a lower retail price for the Genesis, $149 down from $189, would make Nintendo's 16-bit console, whenever they introduced it, appear to be that much more expensive. 3. Marketing. Let Nintendo have the kids. Kalinske wanted everyone else, and he aimed to let them know they were wanted. Sega needed to redefine itself as hip, cool, and in-your-face. Doing so would not only speak to older generations, but present video games as a mainstream form of entertainment, no different from books, movies, and music. Toward that end, Kalinske proposed to increase Sega's advertising budget and create edgy advertisements that mock Nintendo and appealed to teens and college students rather than younger kids. 4. Development. Sega of Japan developed great games, but many of those great games tended to have a particularly Asian appeal. Unsurprisingly, their Japanese brethren at Nintendo had a similar tendency. If Sega wanted to plant their flag in America, they needed to make games for that specific demographic, and SOJ needed to accept SOA's input on how to alter Japanese titles for the American audience, similar to how they had revised Sonic the Hedgehog. To do this, Kalinske wanted to expand Sega of America's product development budget and staff. When Kalinske finished, he inspected the faces of the board members. Their expressions suggested that they were even more unimpressed than they had been before. Any hints of friendliness had now been replaced by shock, confusion, and rage. And moments later, a barrage of angry questions, comments, and concerns flooded the room. Toyota nimbly worked to translate the ruckus as Kalinske tried to address their worries one by one. Eventually, however, there were too many criticisms, and Toyota couldn't keep up with the chorus of condemnation. "You'd think with the law of averages," Kalinske said to Toyota in an aside, "that at least one of them would have something nice to say."
That guy over there called you a tall, handsome American," Toyota replied.
"Oh yeah? Was that all he had to say about me?"
"No comment."
Kalinske could hardly believe what he was saying. These people didn't just disagree with what he had said. His suggestions had actually provoked them to abandon rationality and reply with fury. Somehow, he had struck a nerve. And while it is never a good idea to aim at the Achilles heel of someone you're doing business with, Kalinske knew it was an especially terrible idea to do so in Japanese culture, where form, respect, and honor are valued above all else. Suddenly, Kalinske felt like the walls were closing in around him, and he experienced a powerful sense of deja vu. It was happening again. Just like at Mattel, where he had given the company the best years of his life and assumed that he would be there forever until suddenly he wasn't. He still had trouble making sense of what had happened at Mattel. Everything had been going so well there. His job was his life, and he loved it that way, because at Mattel, he was the best version of himself. In 1981, after a decade of rising through the ranks, he was rewarded for his enormous contributions and named president of the toy division. He felt like he had reached the pinnacle of his career and considered it an honor to spend the rest of his life selling the magic of toys to kids around the world. The promotion enabled him to control most aspects of the production, distribution, and marketing of toys. Most, but not all. Ultimately, because Mattel was a public company, the board of directors had the final word. And if there was one thing the board members cared about, more than growth, money, or making great products, it was being right. Knowing this, Kalinske tried his best to agree with the board, but that wasn't always possible, especially with the new path he envisioned for Mattel. In the early 1980s, conglomeration was the business world's buzzword du jour. It was no longer enough for a company to excel at what they had been doing. Now they had to buy up stakes in unrelated companies and manage those as well. The benefits of entering into unfamiliar industries were said to be diversification, tax breaks, and the possibility of synergy. Kalinske, however, knew the real reason. Power. He could see this in Mattel's board whenever it announced new acquisitions, ranging from the understandable, Ringling Brothers Circus and Western Publishing, to the absurd, Turco Steel and Metaframe Pet Supply. Though Kalinske tended to disagree with this type of corporate expansion, he voiced his doubts to the board only when investment in these new businesses came at the expense of what had gotten Mattel to this point, toys. Whenever he objected, his dissent was noted and not forgotten. The board of directors had the final word, and there were always ways for them to silently retaliate. By 1983, the board's trigger-happy acquisition strategy, coupled with major losses due to the video game crash, had led Mattel to the brink of bankruptcy. Miraculously, the company managed to survive, with the last-minute help of junk bond guru Michael Milken. He raised enough money to keep Mattel afloat while simultaneously making the company leaner by selling off its recent unrelated acquisitions. In the face of failure, the board's power weakened, and some members were let go, but those who remained were not happy to have been proven wrong. Nevertheless, they were in no position to retaliate, since they needed Kalinske's help to rebuild the company. 2 years later, as Mattel flourished, the board of directors rewarded Kalinske's strong stewardship by offering him the position of CEO. He didn't particularly want the job, as it would pull him away from the toy division, but he interpreted the offer as an olive branch from the board of directors and accepted. The relationship briefly worked well, until Kalinske made a jarring discovery. In the year since Milken had restructured the company, interest rates had dropped by half, but Mattel was still paying a much higher rate to its debt holders. He quickly realized what he perceived to be the reason. Any change would require approval from the members of the board, many of whom were also the debt holders. Believing this to be a conflict of interest, Kalinske requested this matter to be voted on, but only by independent board members who did not hold any of Mattel's debt. Naturally, his resolution passed, but it also fostered anger among many of the board members. The directors were still not strong enough to replace Kalinske, but they were powerful and clever enough to point out that he was only 38 and surely would benefit from having some leadership assistance. So they brought in John Ammerman, the 53-year-old head of Mattel's international division, to become his co-CEO, until Kalinske had matured enough to handle the post alone. Unsurprisingly, that never came to pass. In truth, Kalinske and Ammerman got along fine, but the perception was that battle lines had been drawn, and the internal politics between Kalinske and the board spilled into every division of the company, with employees feeling obliged to take sides. Eventually, the perceived turmoil fractured the company and caused it to grind to a halt. Kalinske stepped down, ceding the position to his older and wiser co-CEO. Following the unceremonious end to his tenure, the board tried to keep Kalinske with Mattel by offering him the COO position, but this time he declined, sick of playing politics and believing that there had to be something better out there. Now, years later, he was in front of an equally angry board of directors, having foolishly believed that Nakayama had offered him that something better. As the grumbling from Sega's board continued to mount, Kalinske resorted to what he did best, speaking. Foolish as it may have been, he continued to plead his case. "It sounds crazy, I know, but these are the type of calculated risks that Sega needs to take. Please, just trust me. Aren't you sick and tired of being bested by Nintendo?" It was clear that this comment had struck another nerve. Kalinske turned to Nakayama, who looked almost pleased. Had this been Nakayama's plan all along? Had he hired Kalinske purely for the amusement of watching him fail? Had the entire thing, the wooing in Hawaii, the red carpet treatment in Japan, the promise of autonomy in San Francisco, all been part of some carefully orchestrated charade by Nakayama to get revenge for something years ago that Kalinske either had never known about or no longer remembered? These thoughts hit him harder than any of the gripes from the board did. A few months ago, he'd had no interest in this job, but now, it was the only thing that mattered to him. It was his last chance to make his family proud, to prove that he was as successful as he'd always believed he had been. Nakayama angrily pounded his fist on the table, silencing the room. He stood up sharply, shook his head, and locked eyes with Kalinske. Nakayama opened his mouth to rule on this matter, and as he did, a sly smile graced his face.
"Come. No one agrees with anything you're saying. In fact, everyone in here thinks you are nuts."
Nakayama took a deep breath.
"But this is why I hired you. You may go ahead with the plan."
For a moment, Kalinske's eyes showed disbelief. Then his lips curled into a thin, almost imperceptible smile. "Thank you, Nakayama-san." Nakayama nodded. Then all the emotion seemed to vanish suddenly from his face.
"Now, whatever you do, don't mess up," he said, and promptly exited,
leaving behind 18 furious Japanese men, a dazed translator, and one tall, handsome American
who was now officially allowed to shake things up. And the timing of this could not have been better, as Nintendo was about to release their most deadly weapon yet. Part 2. Sonic vs. Mario. Chapter 13. The Winds of Change. A gust of wind rose from the Ujigawa River and reverberated through the night, rattling between the low-lying mountains of the Higashiyama, Kitayama, and Nishiyama ranges. From there, the breeze whispered its way through the tranquil city of Kyoto, weaving between an ornate contrast of Zen gardens and imperial palaces, before crashing into the impenetrable exterior of an unassuming warehouse. Inside, oblivious to the persistent thumps of wind, an assembly line of Japanese laborers worked through the night. Together they operated with the coordinated chaos of scurrying ants. The laborers had been given strict orders that not a single second could be spared, and as a result, their routine became religion. Unload, assemble, test, package, and ship. Over and over they did this, until every single unit of Nintendo's new gaming console had been sent out for delivery. And while all of this was going on in Kyoto, similarly stealthy efforts were taking place at other warehouses throughout Japan, as part of Nintendo's master plan, Operation Midnight Shipping. The clandestine nature of these arrangements had been ordered by Nintendo's president, Hiroshi Yamauchi, while preparing for the launch of the company's 16-bit Super Family Computer, Super Famicom. He had uncovered rumors that the Yakuza, Japan's organized crime syndicate, planned to hijack deliveries. Though the organization typically trafficked in drugs, currency, and women, their sudden interest in electronic goods was not completely surprising. Wherever strong demand existed, the Yakuza took the necessary measures to be ready with supply. And in late 1990, when retailers received word from Nintendo that the 16-bit system would be available later that month, demand soared to incredible heights. On November 3rd, Osaka's famous Hankyo department store announced that it would take reservations for the Super Famicom. A week later, they had to stop accepting pre-orders due to the sheer number of requests. Most retailers didn't even last that long before changing gears. Some stores set up lottery systems to determine who would be lucky enough to purchase Nintendo's new product, while others allowed customers to place pre-orders only if they agreed to buy other products as well. By the end of it all, 1.5 million people had managed to get their names onto the coveted pre-order lists. However, the majority of these chosen ones would be hugely disappointed. In keeping with their controversial tradition of understocking orders, Nintendo planned to ship only 300,000 units, leaving 80% of those with reservations out of luck. If Nintendo had completely had its way, however, they wouldn't have shipped a single unit. Instead, they would have been content to keep selling their 8-bit products. But Sega's 16-bit system, Kalinske's plan for change, and rumblings about a top-secret mascot had forced their hand. Nevertheless, Nintendo was prepared. They had been working on a 16-bit system of their own since the late 80s, and from a technological standpoint, they could have had something ready for market by late 1990. But because they had to move faster than expected, there was one issue that could not be rectified in time. Backward compatibility. When Yamauchi had originally tasked his engineers with building Nintendo's next-generation system, he made several demands related to price, performance, and graphic capabilities. He also insisted that the new hardware should be able to play the old 8-bit software. This was gravely important, because without that compatibility, the millions of Nintendo games already purchased would instantly become obsolete, and the parents who had bought those games would become angry and less likely to want to pay for new products from the company that had made them feel that way. The burden of accomplishing all this fell onto the shoulders of engineering wizard Masayuki Yumura and his 65-person team dubbed R&D2, who had been responsible for creating the original 8-bit system and the lockout chip that rejected non-Nintendo games. Yumura's Super Famicom dazzled on numerous fronts. The new console could generate 32,768 unique colors. The Genesis had 512,
and 8 channels of audio. The Genesis had 6. And it could retail for 25,000 yen, about $250. Yet, despite his best efforts, Yumura was unable to incorporate backward compatibility without greatly increasing the price by about $75. Yamauchi discussed this issue with his son-in-law, Minoru Arakawa, who harbored plans to soon release a U.S. version of the system. Arakawa pointed out that compact discs had recently begun to replace cassette tapes and vinyl records without causing much of a stir. Perhaps modern consumers were becoming savvy enough to realize that new technology tended to make previous iterations obsolete. They concluded that Nintendo was strong enough to deal with the possible backlash and couldn't afford to hold off on a 16-bit system any longer. To placate the possibility of angry parents, they wanted to make sure they had an it game for the new endeavor. Naturally, they decided that their new super system deserved a new Super Mario Brothers game. This, however, resulted in another problem. Shigeru Miyamoto, the visionary game designer behind the Mario, Zelda, and Donkey Kong franchises, was still in the process of learning the limits, benefits, and nuances of 16-bit technology when he was asked to rush the completion of his new game, Super Mario 4, later retitled Super Mario World. He was proud of his latest iteration, the new costumes, the clever foes, and the bright, beautiful new worlds. But the perfectionist within him worried that it felt too similar to the previous Mario games. By this point, however, there was no turning back. Nintendo was moving full steam ahead, ready to enter the battle for 16 bits. Somewhere in Kyoto, another mighty gust of wind roared past a nondescript warehouse, signaling that sooner or later, a storm would be coming. 2 days later, Tom Kalinske sat in his office reviewing the latest screenshots from Sonic the Hedgehog. The game was coming together beautifully, each level more exciting, energetic, and exotic than the last. It wouldn't be ready for 6 months, but Kalinske viewed this as a good thing, as Sega could use the time wisely. He and Nilsson had decided that they would not do the expected and hype the Hedgehog every step of the way. Instead, they were intent on keeping their secret weapon a secret. There would be no game demos sent out in advance, no early print or television advertisements, and no information given to the press. Then, as the mystery of Sonic spurred curiosity, Sega would leak screenshots or character art as the release date approached. Kalinske knew it would be hard to keep Sonic under wraps, especially with Sega of Japan's habit of revealing confidential information toward the end of financial quarters. But this seemed like the best strategy for unleashing the wonder that was Sonic.
"It's here," Toyota said, poking his head into Kalinske's office.
Kalinske glanced up, noticing that Toyota looked distinctly excited and nervous. "What's here?" he asked.
"It," Toyota said, nodding. "It's here."
Seconds later, Kalinske realized what had arrived. "Bring it to the conference room," he said, standing up. "I'll go ahead and gather the troops." Toyota nodded briskly and shuffled off. For a moment, Kalinske didn't move, embracing the anticipation. After the magnitude of the moment fully hit him, he sprang into action and zigzagged through the office to collect everyone who was interested in seeing Nintendo's Super Famicom. Of the 300,000 consoles that were delivered through Yamauchi's Operation Midnight Shipping, Sega of Japan had somehow managed to get a hold of 2 of them. They kept one for themselves and sent the other to Sega of America so that Kalinske and company could see the face of their enemy. Sega had been positioning themselves against the NES, but Kalinske had always known that the real war, the one that mattered, would come once Nintendo released their 16-bit system. He didn't yet know when that would occur in America, but if history was any indication, Nintendo of America would probably go to market with its 16-bit system a little less than a year after Nintendo's Japanese parent. If that was Nintendo's strategy here, then their new console would hit stores in the fall of 1991. Kalinske very much hoped that was the case, as it would play right into his hands. Not only would it give him at least 9 months of lead time to counteract Nintendo's haymaker, but it would give Sega enough time to properly tease the public about Sonic, build a buzz, and then release him from his cage at a time when he could do the most possible damage. "Please," Kalinske thought. "Please be so foolish as to hold off for a year. Give us more time to learn your weaknesses, more time to acquire space on store shelves, and more time to work our way into the minds of consumers.
Of course, all this wishful thinking was predicated on Nintendo's 16-bit system being something Sega could even compete with. Luckily, Kalinske was about to find out once and for all what he was really up against.
"Isn't this exciting?"
Schroeder asked, gathering around the table with the rest of her eager co-workers.
"I've got butterflies."
"Let's not make too big a deal out of it."